Now, I have a lot of things I want to ask you because you've certainly been a force in your own way in the publishing industry for many, many years. And this little article that your publicist sent me about you shed a lot of light. Have you seen this yet? It's supposed to be in a...
No, I did. That was in the Washington Star.
This was in the Washington Star?
Yes.
I thought that was in a little book of publishing mavericks.
It is. Mm-hmm. They took the... Yeah, that's... Both things are correct. Mm-hmm. It was written originally for the Washington Star by... I thought it very naturally. Randy Sue Coburn. I thought it was a very insightful...
I hope that article didn't help put the Washington Star out of business.
I hope not, because I loved it. And then it was picked up for a book called Mavericks.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what this is. I personally liked it very much, but as you know, it's very favorable.
Very flattering, so, very flattering article.
But no doubt.
Here, I guess you were in the process of publishing. I could tell the date you were about to publish, Mulligan mm-hmm. Stew, which came out. So this must have come out about 78. I think I think Mulligan Stew was. My Sorrentino was out in 78.
You mean you actually know that book?
Yeah, well, I have it. I have it at home. I have several of his. I have several of Sorrentino's things. Mm-hmm. Sorrentino was intimate at one time, and I guess they're no longer intimates. I don't know if that's the proper word of Leroy Jones.
He certainly was. He was also an editor at Grove.
Sorrentino was?
Yes.
Oh, I didn't know that. Tell me how, I don't want to duplicate this, but I probably will in some respects, but I'd like to know a little bit about how Grove Press started and when.
Well, it started totally accidentally, but accidents sometimes are not accidents. In 1951, a friend of mine, a young painter, a woman, said that she had two friends who had started a publishing company on Grove Street in the village in 47, and they'd gone out of business. They'd published three books, and would I be interested? And at the time, I was going to the new school, taking any courses they had on almost anything. I'd made films before, and I'd been in the Army Photographic Corps. And I said it sounded great. It was always what I'd been looking for. So I took over the three titles.
Now, wait a minute. You were well-heeled enough to buy a publishing house?
I think it cost about $2,000.
To buy the whole house with their entire...
That included the inventory.
Of how many books?
Oh, 1,000 books, 1,500.
Mm-hmm.
One was a novel of Melville. Another was the poetry of Richard Crashaw. And another of a... English woman writer Aphra Behn, the 17th century. They were all good books. I liked them. And I took them home in a trunk to my apartment on the top of a brownstone on 9th Street.
This is where you moved the publishing house?
That's where I took it. That's where I was living.
So you bought the publishing house, their back titles and all of that, and moved it to your apartment?
Right. Wasn't difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Carried it all upstairs myself.
Then what happened?
Then we began doing other books. At that point it was me, but soon became others. We started with a novel of Henry James. And then we did a strange English novelist, the 17th century, the monk, I can't even think, Matthew Lewis, and went on to other things. It was a natural thing for me. I mean, that was something that I was looking for without knowing it. And with what then seemed like a small amount of money, became larger as time went on. We went on, I gradually expanded from my apartment to another one next door, and then to a loft over a hot dog stand on Broadway. Then the University Place. Then we made a grand tour of the village. And I'm a Chicagoan, so it was a grand tour for me. Now it's come full circle. The company is back again where I live. In my house.
back in the old apartment?
Not in the old apartment, but my own house.
In the same building?
No, on Houston Street. I've always kept moving downtown
mm-hmm.
in the village.
Well, how did it happen that you developed this interest that you actually wanted to spring for this publishing house? I mean, what in your childhood in Chicago and your education led you to this direction?
Well, I went to a school that I think is, at least in the Midwest, is now quite legendary. It's Francis Parker School in Chicago. It was one of the original progressive schools. Also in the 30s, a great number of the Germans from the Bauhaus and others actually came to Chicago. And I, as a child, became involved very much in my school and with these émigrés. One of the first things that I always noticed was that our textbooks were done by Grosset and Dunlap. By crossing off the G, I was already in the publishing business. And later, I remember in the eighth grade, a friend of mine and myself put out a newspaper, which we called the Anti-Everything. You can begin to see what happened. I went to Swarthmore, where I wrote my freshman English paper on Tropic of Cancer of Henry Miller in 1940, which became very useful when I had a trial in Chicago. Many years later, the district attorney accused me of not knowing anything about the book. I accidentally brought along my paper. So it was a, it wasn't all that accidental.
I want to get into some of those censorship cases, but to go back to the formation of Grove Press, actually, I guess it was a good time for you to do it. It was in the 1950s, and I think I was in college in the 50s, and while this was a rather relatively placid era, it was also, I had the feeling, it was a period of experimentation in terms of writing and publishing. There seemed to be a lot of that, perhaps more then than there is today. So perhaps you were kind of on the crest of a wave in a way, weren't you?
I think you're right. I think we were very lucky. I had always tremendously admired New Directions, Jay Laughlin's New Directions from the time I was... started college in 1940, and I think I consciously modeled myself after New Directions, and they were flourishing at that time. But there seemed to be more room for newcomers, as you say. It was a moment of. I personally was more interested in painting than in writing at that time, but there was a certain kind of explosiveness that was going on. Jackson Pollock and Willem de Kooning and Franz Klein, and with me, that went along with a lot of the writing of the time. Remember also at the New School, William Styron was a student when I was there. And so it was a moment of ferment which became much, much stronger in the 60s.
Of course, we associate Grove Press with a lot of experimental writers, but at the same time, I have a feeling they didn't make much money for you, that Grove Press had to reach out in other areas in order to make the publishing house solvent. Is that right?
That's true. One of our first authors was Samuel Beckett, and I decided to publish Waiting for Godot in 1953. I believe, I can remember, because I went to Paris on my honeymoon and met Beckett, and we'd already decided to publish Godot. And although it was very slow going, we have now sold over 1.5 million copies of Waiting for Godot, which I don't know, but I have a feeling is some sort of a world's record for a play.
Mm.
So they were some of these things were very difficult, but then there were the rewards.
You published, did you say you published all of Beckett's?
Everything, yeah. I think we now have 28 volumes in print, Beckett.
Who were some of the other writers that you picked up over the years?
Well, Harold Pinter from England, for example, Tom Stoppard, both of whom very well known today in New York, David Mamet, who went to the same high school I did in Chicago. So we share the same background, but 20 years apart. But we actually had the same teachers. From France, Alain Robrier, Jean Genet, And again, Henry Miller, started with at Swarthmore, and it became very important to me that I publish Tropic of Cancer
legally
in this country.
You're not going to leave out William Burroughs?
I certainly should not leave out William Burroughs, Selby's Last Exit to Brooklyn, John Retchie, City of Night, and quite a few others, Marguerite Duras. We did, probably more European writers than anybody else in the 60s.
At what point did you start running afoul of the people who were censoring our literature from us?
I started running afoul of them when I deliberately did it, which was with Lady Chatterley's Lover. I ran a newspaper when I was in the eighth grade called Anti-Everything, and one of the things we were anti was censorship. And it seemed to me that D.H. Lawrence is a great writer, acknowledged throughout the world as being such, that Lady Chatterley's Lover is a very, very good book, that had never been published in this country legally, and or in any other way, as far as I know. And I chose that book on a very cold basis as a way to challenge censorship in this country, and prepared for it very carefully. Tried to pick the right lawsuit, which in this case was with the federal government as opposed to a local one, and that one worked out very, very well. And it was a long, bitter fight, but we won it.
Isn't something like that a little bit expensive to try to take to the courts?
It was very expensive, and I think I was very naive at the time, but I was saved because we sold a lot of copies of the book, of the paperback book. Once we had won the case with the hardcover book, which didn't sell so terribly many, we went on to do the paperback. Of course, the minute that we did the paperback, three other publishers joined in with us because the book was out of copyright. And that was a little problem because we were up against three very powerful other American publishers, but I don't know how they did, but we did very well. So the lawsuits were paid for in that case.
But that wasn't your only lawsuit.
No.
Yeah, tell me about the others.
Well, then after that, and this again was a sort of a plan, was to do Tropic of Cancer of Henry Miller. Tropic of Cancer was first published, I believe, in Paris in 1937. And I really liked the book very much. And it really had very little to do with the sexuality in it, which to me is a sort of a surrealist variety. But I admired his ideas, thoughts, particularly some of his feelings of the not loving to live in America in the 30s. So that was to come after Lady Chatterley, but it took me years to convince Henry Miller to allow us to publish it. No matter what our commercial expectations may have been, he most certainly wasn't interested in his commercial hopes, because it took me, I'd say, 4 years of badgering him to let us publish the book.
Why? It had already been published in Europe?
It had been published in Europe, but not here. And Henry was living in Big Sur, where I made a pilgrimage to see him. And he said, I'm living peacefully on the edge of the precipice. And if that book gets published here, the American Legion will attack me. And I don't want that. I just want to be quiet and live my life out. And I said, I think you're very wrong. It's a great book, and you owe it to yourself and to the rest of us to allow the book to be done. And he said no. But several years later, a person I think is his best friend, a German publisher, his name is Lady Rowald, in Hamburg, sent me a cable saying, come over here right away. I think I've got Henry to agree to let you publish it. So I went immediately, signed him up, and then we went ahead and published the book.
Then there was Naked Lunch. You had to go to battle for that, didn't you?
We did. That was a very interesting battle, and that one took place in Massachusetts. A bookstore person was arrested there. At that time, I think that Mr. Richardson, who later became the Attorney General, was the Lieutenant Governor, and Mr. Brooks, who later became the Senator, was the Attorney General of Massachusetts. One way, the two of them, anyway. They were both Republicans. Very important. Anyway, a bookstore owner of a very sort of 42nd Street store was very carefully arrested for selling naked lunch, and we went up there, and my attorney, Ed DeGrazia, and over a period of months, we really developed a friendship with the people in the government there, and they said, why don't you rewrite the law for us so that we don't arrest a bookstore person, but arrest the book. Arrest the book, and thereby the publisher, and don't put the onus on the bookstore. Because once you arrest a bookstore person, then you've had a chilling effect on the community. If you can remove it one step from the bookstore to the publisher, you do a great service. And we did do exactly that. And they changed the law in Massachusetts. And we also had a big trial up there with people like Norman Mailer was our star witness, and so on. We also won the trial. But I thought more important than winning it was changing the law.
Meanwhile, Burroughs was sitting it out in Algiers, buying morphine over the counter.
As far as I know.
Well, somewhere in all this ferment, somewhere along the line, Evergreen Magazine appeared. Tell me about its origins.
Well, that came about, again, I think, as a natural part of the times. There were many other little magazines, so-called. And also in our publishing, we got in great deal of wonderful material from people whose books we just couldn't publish. I mean, there was just too many. Or somehow or other they were being published by other people, but still were sending us little poems, stories. So it almost became incumbent upon us to bring out our own magazine, and which we did. And I think the second issue, for example, was all San Francisco. It slowly began to dawn on us that in 1957, there was a tremendous ferment in San Francisco. Lawrence Ferlinghetti, Allen Ginsberg, Michael McClure, Snyder, and a whole group of writers. So we did one issue called San Francisco Scene.
That was the first issue.
That was the second. That was the second one. In the first issue, we had Samuel Beckett, for example. So, I mean, and this, in a way, is the new one, in a way, you see, is a circle.
Yes.
You'll see we have Ferlinghetti and we have Samuel Beckett. And we also have a lot of new people. But that's not accidental that it has. Again, it has Beckett and Ferlinghetti. Terry Southern, whom we never published as an author, but whose work we always admired, is in this issue.
Well, Evergreen thrived for a while, but how many years did was it put out before it faded away?
I think about 15 years. And it actually didn't fade away. We, for reasons that had very little to do with the magazine, that had to do with complications of a book club and so forth, actually stopped it when it was doing reasonably well.
Mm-hmm.
It had a circulation of over 100,000.
What made you change your mind and bring it out again?
Nothing made me change my mind. As the years went by and the same situation built up again, that we have, again, get things from authors, many of whom we don't publish. And many of these authors have come to us and said, why don't you do it again? As Robert Coover is one, for example. Herb Gold in San Francisco said, you must go on and give it another shot. So eventually we decided to do it.
Is the material in this revival issue, is it all new?
Yes.
It's all fresh materials never been published before, including the Becketts?
Yes, including the Becketts.
Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, what was happening to Grove Press? Because it was expanding and contracting, expanding and contracting. So what direction was Grove Press going in?
Well, I'd say it was always in the same direction.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right. We had a book club. We had a big magazine, relatively big. And we had a lot of problems that came up along the way, but I think we have continued now for over 30 years with... You can see certain threads that run all the way through it. Let's say somebody like Beckett or Henry Miller or Harold Pinter. That those same people going through it, and also the search for new things, for new people. Well, you know, we can only take that which is offered us. When I started publishing, I would have loved to have published Hemingway, Faulkner. Unfortunately, they were taken.
Somebody else had them first.
Somebody else had them first.
I had done an interview with A.E. Hotchner. I think he's on this week. There's usually about a 2 or 3 week lag, mm-hmm. so sometimes I forget exactly what week it runs. But he, at one time, as he put it, he worked for Cosmopolitan, which was a literary magazine, as he said before. It was deflowered by Helen Gurley Brown. And the editor, then a chum of his in the Army, didn't have a regular job for him, but he said, I'll give you a job as a literary bounty hunter, because we have all these authors who had written for Cosmopolitan, and they're not writing. We don't even know where they are. So one of the authors was Hemingway, and Hotchner went down to wherever Hemingway was, I presume in Cuba, and they had a friendship that lasted 14 years, and over drinks they had this friendship, and across the river and into the trees. Yeah. That novel was given to Cosmopolitan to serialize first because of that. So, yes, you're right. Hemingway was taken thanks to people like Hotchner. You've certainly had a long career as a publisher, and I would assume, looking at you now, you seem to have no regrets whatsoever. Would you ever have decided to go into something else? Looking back over the years?
No. No, I think people like me who don't have any really tremendous skill in any one given thing, publishing is a very good sort of all-around trade.
I doubt that. What has given you the greatest satisfaction in this lengthy career with Grove Press? All the things you've done with regard to publishing and all the authors that you've dealt with?
Well, I hate to keep bringing his name up, but meeting and publishing, Samuel Beckett has been one of the greatest. I think what we managed to do in Evergreen Review was very important to me. But it's not all in the past. Just this within this last year, we published a book edited by my son, who's teaches at the University of Michigan, but has been in Nicaragua for the last year and a half. And another professor from the University of Michigan did a book for us on Nicaragua. And that's always been a part of Grove. It's been a political end. That gave me a great deal of pleasure, because I think it happens to be a very good book and something that I happen to agree with. As a matter of fact, I went to Nicaragua in November, and I'm going to go there again this Sunday.
Well, it looks to me like Barney Rossett and the Grove Press, you all are not afraid to continue to make people mad. Shake up the world a little bit. You've done that for a long time. I guess you're going to have every intention of continuing.
Now we don't want to make them too mad.
Well, they're
just awakened.
Listen, it was. I'm glad that you came in to talk to me in this casual way. There's a lot more I can ask you, but I'm going to have to wait through half an hour's worth of material now. And it's just a little show, but I envision a multi-part broadcast with you to trace some of the history of Grove Press and yourself and some of the people that you've dealt with. Incidentally, what kind of... I think you'd mentioned Beckett, and that gave you a lot of satisfaction working with him, but in general, what kind of relationship do you, as a publisher, develop with maverick authors such as Burroughs and some of these others?
Well, they differ very, very wildly. We've had very close personal relationships with some, such as John Retchie, and practically no relationship whatsoever. with others. But then there have been other people at Grove Press, including Dick Seaver, who's now the head of Holt Reinhardt's trade book section, who is very important at Grove, and whom I met in 1953, the same time I met Beckett. Dick also established his own relationships with people which came into Grove. Fred Jordan, who's my co-editor now of Evergreen, has been very, very, very important also. So,
is Jordan still at Grove Press?
Yes, yeah, he's the co-editor of this now. So, and Don Allen, who is my original co-editor at Grove, had close personal relationships with a number of people. So I'd say, let's say, between the four of us, we had close relationships with many of the authors. Alain Robbe-Grillet is, I think, a pretty great French author. He's a close friend of mine. Others, Marguerite Duras was a close friend of Dick Seaver's, also of mine. So we've sort of crossed over, gone backwards and forwards and crisscrossed through the years. It's very nice to be a friend of an author. David Mamet, as I say, we went to the same high school in Chicago.
He wrote American Buffalo, didn't he?
He wrote American Buffalo, and he wrote Glengarry Glen Ross.
It was on the Pulitzer Prize. I never did figure out American Buffalo. I sat and I went to the theater to watch that, and that was somehow just beyond me. But the critics just raved about it, and it came back. See, I saw it with Robert Duvall.
And then he played in it. You saw him when he was in it.
Yeah, he was in it, on its original appearance. Right. And then it was just back, I believe, last year.
Al Pacino.
With Al Pacino.
Right. Well, Glengarry Glen Ross carries American Buffalo further. And when you see Glengarry Glen Ross, maybe it clarifies American Buffalo. It's really tough, outspoken Americana, and yet which comes out of Pinter and Beckett in its own way.
How do plays sell? Did you publish American Buffalo?
Yes.
How does a play sell other than, say, to would-be actors or theatrical people who would perform these in high schools or something? Well, I guess American Buffalo would never be in a high school. But.
Oh, I wouldn't be surprised.
No, it's language.
I know. Where do you see Glengarry Glen Ross? You think of course, your language American Buffalo.
I don't think I have, of course, hearing high school kids speak today.
Well,
their language is worse than mine.
Right. Some plays really do sell. Waiting for Godot was a great example. Several of the Pinter plays, Stoppard's, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, which was a number of years ago, and plays of his after that. The Elephant Boy sold very well, republished. Unfortunately, The Dresser of Harwood didn't, which I sort of surprised me, because I thought it was a very accessible story, and very poignant. But
on average, how do you decide the number of printings for a play such as American Buffalo?
Impossible. Just totals.
You hold your finger up to the wind?
Exactly.
5,000?
5,000.
2,000?
2,000.
You just guess at it?
That's right. 1,000? 10,000?
Isn't it great that there's so much scientific accuracy to publishing?
I don't think there's any whatsoever.
Well, it's really tough, isn't it? To know what to do and what the taste is going to be, and tougher, I would assume, for Grove Press because, in many instances, with the fiction and the plays, I think you've reached a much more specialized audience than.
I know. One of the only things that really would have put us into a big area was the Tolkien trilogy, which I turned down.
No.
I couldn't understand a word of it, and I thought, who wants to read about all those hobbits? So on.
If you understood American Buffalo, you
know. That I could understand, but not Tolkien, and I've since had two sons who have literally memorized all of his books.